And welcome back to Coast, Dr. Michael Sala with us as we talk about Space Force, our Star Trek future. And this hour, we will take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Dr. Michael Sala. Michael, this is book six. Is there going to be a book seven?
Yes, I'm still trying to decide whether I'm going to try and do one on the Russian, French, and Indian space programs, given that I'm essentially still locked down in Hawaii, or do it on the Dark Fleet, which is the breakaway German program. So still deciding on that one, but there will be a book seven.
Now, how did you get involved in the Secret Space Force? What was it that captured you?
I was really intrigued by Space Force. I mean, like everyone, the possibility of a united military force out there where they're recruiting people and eventually it growing into something like Star Trek, kind of like really was very inspiring. I mean, and it's interesting that so many thousands of military service people are trying to transfer over to Space Force because it does inspire the imagination. And that's something that I know when I was a youngster back in Australia that I would have definitely signed up for a Space Force because that's a dream I had. And a lot of people have a similar dream of traveling out into space. And so I think that is part of our growth as a civilization, is to just expand our minds and imaginations into contemplating space. And so, yeah, Space Force was very inspiring.
What are the Artemis Accords?
Well, that is a very important development. They were signed in October of 2020, and they are a set of bilateral accords between the U.S. and seven other major spacefaring nations such as Britain, Australia, and other countries like Japan, and there are more that are in the process of signing up and joining that. And that is setting up this multinational space alliance where the U.S., with its major allies, all collaborate across the military, the civilian, and the commercial arenas to really make space a place where all major nations can collaborate and improve their economies while also protecting their space assets. And, you know, the underlying, one of the kind of principal reasons for the U.S. moving down the track of a multinational alliance is that U.S. policymakers, you know, look down the track 10, 20 years, and they understand that China is going to become, and already is, the global economic hegemon. That the China's economy, at the moment, in terms of PPP, China's economy is larger than the U.S. In absolute nominal U.S. dollar terms, it will China will exceed the U.S. economy by around 2025, and what that means is that in 10 years, 20 years, China's economy will be so big that it will be able to fund its military to have a budget that's greater than the U.S. And that means that China, because it's going to be focusing on space, China recognizes space as the strategic high ground. It's developing 5G satellite systems. It's developing AI. It's developing the Internet of Things because it understands that space and satellite communications is really going to be dominant for establishing national security in the years ahead. That the only way the U.S. can counter that is to collaborate with its partners like Britain, like Canada, like Japan, like Australia, and form a multinational alliance and get as many of the world's democracies to sign up and become a part of that, so that way China's growing economic and military power doesn't translate it into becoming the dominant space and global power.
We're going to take your calls here on Coast to Coast Now with Dr. Michael Sulla. Let's go to Wayne in Chicago to get us started. Hi, Wayne. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, George. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Yes, Dr. Sulla. If you can enlighten us on the Black Knight satellite, supposedly a mysterious object that has been in near polar orbit for thousands of years. If you know anything about that, sir, I appreciate you letting us know something.
It's from the star system, they say, Michael, Epsilon Bootis.
Well, it's very interesting. I know that the Black Knight satellite was something that was spotted in the 1950s. This was in the days just before the Sputnik satellite went up in 1957. And so they did see something up there. Now, you know, some people call it the Black Knight satellite, something going back hundreds of years, if not earlier. Others thought it was a craft, a mothership, belonging to a group of extraterrestrial races. So it could have been, I suspect it was probably a spacecraft that belonged to one of these civilizations that is monitoring Earth affairs, and that they had some kind of satellite up there.
Next up, let's go to Thomas in La Jolla, California. Hey, Tom, thanks for calling.
Hi, George. Thank you for accepting my call. And, you know, the Coast to Coast audience is just fantastic. I always love when Wayne from Chicago calls in. Very insightful questions. And, Michael, you're doing magnificent work. Comment and then a question. And William Mills Tompkins, he was United States Navy. He wrote a book called Selected by Extraterrestrials. He contended that the United States Navy actually developed a space fleet in the 1950s as a result of World War II. And so that was like 10 years before Star Trek. He contended that we had Star Trek starting in the 1950s, and the United States Navy was in charge of that. And it sounds fantastic, Michael, but when you stop and think about it, you stop and think about projects like the Manhattan Project in World War II. It employed 800,000 people in the United States, yet how many people knew what was actually going on with the Manhattan Project? Maybe 8, possibly 10 people out of 800,000 people. So the government can keep secrets. The military can keep secrets.
Yep.
Transnational corporations can keep secrets. So my question is, how do we reassess? I know you're familiar with William Mills Tompkins. He's passed away at 94 recently.
Mm-hmm.
And how would you reassess his idea that we had a space fleet in the 1950s?
Well, I just want to clarify there that Bill Tompkins said that in the 1950s he was working at Douglas Aircraft Company and in an advanced think tank, and that there were three human-looking extraterrestrials that were embedded in there that were helping him come up with designs on behalf of the U.S. Navy for a future space fleet. And that in the 1960s, those early designs were handed over to engineers, to architects, to come up with the specific detailed plans for the construction of these craft, and that the actual construction of the craft came in the 1970s, and then they were tested and deployed in the late 70s and early 80s. That was the sequence, according to Bill Tompkins. And that kind of fits in with this idea that Gene Roddenberry, around 1965, 66, when he was sitting in on that season of The Outer Limits with Leslie Stevens,
mm-hmm.
that he was briefed about this Navy space program because they were already putting together the detailed architectural plans for the construction of these space battle groups that were eventually deployed in the 70s and 80s. So that's exactly how Roddenberry knew what the Navy was planning to do, because the Navy was already being helped by these extraterrestrials that Bill Trumpton says he interacted with at Douglas Aircraft Company.
What do you know about the CIA's involvement in any of this, Michael?
Well, the CIA actually is a major player in a secret space programs. It's something that I understood much more as I was doing the research for this latest book on Space Force. Is because the CIA, from the very beginning, has worked very, very closely with the National Reconnaissance Office. I mistakenly assumed that the National Reconnaissance Office worked closely with the Air Force and the Pentagon, which it does and it has done, but the real power and the real influence over the National Reconnaissance Office, so the NRO, is the CIA, because the CIA is what has traditionally supplied the NRO with its funding from the black budget. And currently, what has happened is that because the CIA has been able to arrange for the construction of a new space agency called the Space Reconnaissance Office that is nominally under CIA control, it is run by the CIA, so that way the Pentagon doesn't have any say in how it's run, but it's actually staffed and managed by the NRO on behalf of the CIA. So the end result is that the CIA and the NRO have an advanced space program, a secret space program, with all of these anti-gravity technologies that have been secretly built from this black budget that the CIA has accumulated over many decades. And it's a very powerful program. It's used for surveillance. They have stealth space stations. They have squadrons of anti-gravity craft, TR-3Bs, flying saucer craft, that are part of this Space Reconnaissance Office. And so this is something that is very important for the future of the Space Force, is because the CIA, NRO, space activities are all excluded from the oversight of Space Force. So that means that Space Force has to deal with the NRO, CIA space program in the future.
Let's go to Cheryl in Washington, Missouri. Hi, Cheryl. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Hi, George. Hi, Michael.
Hi there.
Hi.
This is so cool. A long time ago, I used to like hit yard sales and sell on eBay. And I found a 1965 TV guide, and there was an interview in there with Gene Roddenberry. I mean, that was pretty cool.
A classic.
Yes, a classic, total classic. But he was asserting that he was teaching diversity kind of thing, that was part of the Star Trek, reason for the show and everything. And this whole thing with the anti-gravity, in addition, it's about, I think it's magnetism kind of thing. I think that magnets, because they're so polar or whatever, but harnessing that kind of matter and that energy, I think that'd be cool.
How far ahead was Roddenberry from his time, Gene, Michael?
Well, I mean, clearly he was decades ahead of his time, and I think that was because he was influenced either directly or indirectly by these human-looking extraterrestrials that were likely part of some kind of galactic federation or confederation of planets, such as depicted in the Star Trek series. And what really, I think, inspired the imagination of everyone that watched the early Star Trek series was that there weren't any interpersonal conflicts among the crew of Star Trek. You had a very kind of harmonious interpersonal dynamic there. And that was different. That was so different to the way people saw life and interacted with others. And they naturally embraced that idea that, much more advanced future society that, of course, interpersonal relations will be harmonious and peaceful, and you're not going to have these kind of dysfunctionality as we see in ordinary society.
We're with Dr. Michael Sala. His website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Where do we get this book, Space Force?
They can go to the website if you wanted to get an autographed copy, or just go to Amazon.com, and it's listed there along with all the other books in the series.
Let's go to Kevin in South Pasadena, California. Kev, go ahead.
Hi, good evening, George and Dr. Sala.
Hi there.
I just wanted to say, as you were talking with Thomas, and he was mentioning the other fellow that had worked for McDonnell Douglas and the connection to Gene Roddenberry, the space station model that was used in the Star Trek episode Trouble with Tribbles was actually a prototype space station designed by McDonnell Douglas. The prototype model was given to the production company for Star Trek, and they re-detailed it a little bit and used it on the episode. So that's just kind of an interesting part of trivia there.
That was a great segment, too. Trouble with Tribbles. You remember that, Michael, or not?
Yeah, I do remember that. And, definitely Douglas Aircraft Company and McDonnell Douglas, the consortium that was built out of Douglas, they were working on a lot of advanced space concepts, space stations. The manned orbiting laboratory was going to be a military space station. So that was something that that Douglas also put together. And William Tompkins was a part of all of that.
Is there, Michael, a Galactic Federation?
I think so. I mean, this is something that a lot of people have speculated about. A lot of insiders and contactees have talked about it. But what really, I think, really was solid evidence for this was the recent comments by Professor Haim Eshed, the
Israeli security director, wasn't he?
The founder of Israel's space program. I mean, that he set it up and ran Israel's spy satellite system for close to 30 years. And he was involved with all of the advanced technology projects for the Israeli military even before he headed up the Israel Space Agency. So he said that there was a Galactic Federation, and that, in fact, the Galactic Federation had advised the Trump administration, that was intent on disclosing its existence, that the Galactic Federation said, no, humanity isn't ready yet, that technologically we're not up to speed. So it appears that we need to kind of like go a little further down the track of developing advanced technologies and becoming a space-faring society. So maybe that's where people like Elon Musk come in, to kind of get us out there a little more.
That could be. Michael, we're going to come back in just a moment and take final phone calls with you on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, Alan Steinfeld joins us with his work, Making Contact, Preparing for the New Realities of Extraterrestrial Existence. So get ready for that. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, our final segment with Dr. Michael Sala. Michael, are guided missiles guided by GPS systems now? Because in the past, we never had GPS, and we still had missiles.
Well, yes, the guided missiles and many of the other smart weapons that the U.S. military uses are dependent on GPS. As I mentioned, about 70% of the entire U.S. military technologies are based on GPS systems. So if that was knocked out, then the U.S. military would be really almost crippled all around the world.
Or if we knocked theirs out.
Well, other countries don't have such sophisticated smart weapon systems because they have never had or don't have
Russia doesn't have it?
Oh, Russia definitely has it, and yeah. China has. But, you know, if we're talking countries like North Korea or Iran, I mean, they don't really have that same reliance on guided missile systems.
Can you knock out a satellite without them knowing who did it?
Yeah, there's a number of ways of doing it now. I mean, there's a cyber hacking that there could also be electronic jamming, and so that would knock out a satellite without the satellite owner knowing exactly who did it. I mean, there are kind of anti-satellite killers out there that presumably could also sneak up to a satellite and knock it out, and that, you know, the US wouldn't know who did that. But if it was a ground-launched missile or an air-launched missile that knocked down a satellite, then it would be pretty easy to work out who was behind it.
Back to the phones. Michael in Yuma, Arizona joins us. Hey, Mike, go ahead. Welcome to the program.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi there.
Aloha.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing, Mike.
I got a question here for Dr. Sala. I'd like to get your thoughts on this. The U.S. government acknowledges the existence of UFOs, at which point one could speculate some of those UFOs are operated by ETs, which could potentially pose a threat. With that in mind, do you think that the operations that Space Force would get involved in would necessitate a specialized combat unit? And what I mean by that is a combat astronaut.
For UFOs, what do you think, Michael?
Well, yeah, they have been training special operators for fighting all kinds of unconventional enemies, and that would include extraterrestrials. That has been happening for some time now. We do know there was a story a few months ago about Britain's SAS actively training to deal with extraterrestrial foes. And why that's important now is because next month, when the intelligence community report on UAPs is released or handed over to the Senate, which then has the authority to release that, that will be an authoritative report on the UAP phenomenon. And I expect, and many people believe, that what it's going to talk about is these UAPs as this unknown threat. And so, you know, they won't know exactly who's piloting them, but it will be considered a threat. So that's when they will have to start training military personnel and astronauts in things such as unconventional warfare.
In doing your research for Space Force, did you come across anything that just shocked you?
There were some things that were really kind of a big surprise, such as the CIA's partnership with the NRO, the NRO-CIA could be like this. I can't remember what it was in Star Trek, Section 17, this kind of quasi-intelligence branch in Star Trek that really was kind of like the nemesis of the conventional Star Trek program, and that this was kind of like an intelligence unit that did all of these things in terms of unconventional warfare, also involved in things like temporal war. So that was very interesting that we actually have that happening right now, that in the future, not only can we have the development of this kind of Star Trek future, but we also have this kind of very mysterious, nebulous Section 17, which is outside of the authority of Space Force.
Next up, we've got Blair in Sedona, Arizona. Take it away, Blair.
Thank you, George. First, I want to thank you, George, for playing Sarah Vaughan, Broken Hearted Melody, a few months ago.
Oh, sure.
That was my very first favorite song when I was 8, 9 years old. It was spectacular.
Okay.
Dr. Sala, I agree with what you said about a galactic civilization overseeing saying we're not ready. Chemical rockets are not the answer. We're injuring our atmosphere, and you could say our galactic overseers, if you will, are constantly patching up the holes we're making. What would you say to that?
Well, if we're talking about rocket systems that companies like SpaceX are sending up there, that, that's on the increase. I mean, what we have now with our Starship, I mean, they just did a successful launch. I think it was out, was today that Starship SN15 was successfully launched and then landed without any mishap. That was the first one in the series of Starship launches. And Starship is going to be used for the 2024 mission to land a woman on the moon and to restart this whole kind of astronaut presence on the moon and then as a launching pad for Mars. So that's going to continue for some time. And I think SpaceX plans to up the ante with these space launches. Now, at some point, there's going to be the development or the public unveiling of some of these more advanced anti-gravity technologies that takes us away from rocket propulsion systems. I mean, hopefully that's going to happen sooner rather than later, but we don't know when that's going to happen. But between now and then, it's going to be companies like SpaceX using reusable rockets, using methane and kerosene, which, of course, I agree, is terribly destructive to the atmosphere, but that's the situation we're in.
Let's go to Cynthia, first-time caller, Silver City, Nevada. Hello, Cynthia.
Good evening. I thank you so much for taking my call. I would love to talk to you every night. I have comment and question every night, but tonight's the night I really wanted to say I hope I saw our Space Force tonight, but I was sitting out on my patio around 9, Southern Vista, and all of a sudden it just lit up like a pearl necklace in the sky. And the more I started looking at it, I realized it was moving, and it looked like those fiber optic lamps from a long time ago with the water dripping down looking look.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And heading, horizontal to the east, I am about 60 miles from Fallon Naval Air Station. And I am under the flight path. So I see a lot of, aircraft. Usually, and especially like this time of night, I, hear them maybe before I see their lights. There was nothing like that. It was totally surreal. It made my mouth just drop open. I had quite a bit of time to contemplate all this and try to count. And, my head was looking, straight ahead when I first saw this. And I keep turning my head like 90 degrees just trying to count. I would say there was like several hundred of these lights, all in pretty much perfect formation. There'd be little gaps every so often of a what looked like a larger, space between. But then I kind of wasn't sure that I wasn't seeing something in between that maybe just had a lesser light. I don't know there was no sound. And even, the crickets that are making a lot of music tonight, it was like everything was silent. I had, anyway, I'm mainly just calling to report because for some reason I feel like I was meant to see this. I came back inside to check the time. I don't use a cell phone. And I was thinking, it's a 555 day. So anyway, happy days. George, I know you're coming west. I live in a living ghost town. I live in a paranormal alternate reality house. I have, like, ghosty spirits of different eras. I have lots of stories to keep you and your people. I would make you a fabulous dinner if you and your people ever wanted to come to dinner.
All right, very nice of you, Cynthia. David, what do you think of some of the things she said, Michael?
Well, I mean, first thing that came to mind was that maybe that pool of lights that she saw, Cynthia, that that could have been the Starlink satellites that SpaceX has been sending up there regularly. But then she mentioned that she saw several hundred of them. So that makes me think, well, it could be something else. I mean, that would be a formation of something, because definitely They don't have several hundred flying in formation when we're talking about the Starlink satellites.
Exciting stuff. Let's go to Joe, Long Island, New York. Hi, Joe. Go ahead.
Yeah, Michael. Leonard Nimoy and the crew of the original Star Trek, the actual actors, were they just actors? I'm curious about that. I'm also curious about whether the Challenger actually happened and if we have a base on the moons of Saturn like Titan.
The Challenger accident, you're saying?
Yes.
It happened, Joe. It was a tragic loss, and I believe that was 1986, was it not, Michael?
Something like that, yeah. That was the first serious space shuttle accident. I think as far as the base on the moon is concerned, I think there are secret bases on the moon. I think what we are witnessing now is that whoever owned those secret bases on the moon, and we can talk about different extraterrestrial races being involved in that, that the moon is now opening up. That's why I think the Artemis program and landing humans on the moon again in 2024 and establishing bases, and Russia and China are doing the same thing. The moon is opening up, and maybe there's been a change in management up there, but definitely something is different, because some people say that the Apollo astronauts were warned off the moon in the 70s. So if we're going back in 2024, something's changed in the 50 years, change of management. As for the Star Trek
actors, yeah.
Were they just actors? Very, very interesting. Certainly Leonard Nimoy and William Shatner, I mean, they were involved in The Outer Limits. They worked very closely with Leslie Stevens. So they could well themselves have been involved in this secret space program or being briefed about it. So definitely, I think it's an intriguing question and deserves further investigation.
Of the secret space program, Michael, what would you like to know that we don't know yet?
What I'd love to know is whether the Galactic Federation actually had recruited either Gene Roddenberry or Leslie Stevens to work with them in some kind of tour of service and then return them with the expectation that they would kind of put this out in a fictionalized version to prepare humanity for the future where we would actually eventually have open contact with this Galactic Federation.
What's your gut tell you?
I think so. I think, I think the Galactic Federation is this association of very friendly, positive human extraterrestrials that are trying to help us make the adjustment to a future where life in the universe is perceived to be abundant, and that we have to be responsible in how we conduct ourselves both on planet Earth and in space.
David, thanks for being on the program. Michael Sala, and really appreciate it. I called him David. He sounds like David Serrata sometimes. Up next, Making Contact. Alan Steinfeld joins us on Coast to Coast AM.